So my name is Miki, and the theme of this talk is the HPPA risk architecture, which I was involved a little bit in the 90s when I was porting OpenBSD operating system to these machines. When in the middle 90s there were a couple of university projects, mostly HP sponsored, that released a little bit of code that allowed to do the porting because there was no documentation before. I don't want to talk about the porting efforts because it might be some completely different audience for this, but a little bit more about the machines, which I think it's, in my opinion, it's pretty sad that they abandoned the whole architecture, because I think it actually had a lot of future they could still continue with. So this is actually one of the first models that they made in the 1986, which was only 3 months after MIPS released the first MIPS RISC CPU. Before there were no RISC CPUs, they had a huge competition, and basically MIPS has to had to release CPU with bugs, with known bugs, just to be first. And the HP couldn't afford it because they were paid by the military, so it has to work. So the first CPU was actually not a silicon, it was a multi-board TTL logic, four boards for the CPU. Actually had a really huge TLB, it was about 9,000 entries, which is even for modern times kind of strange number. They actually decreased it over time. I think it was more or less experimental, see how it works and what was happening. So on the right is just a disk drive and stuff, and the left basically the cabinet where they had the four boards, CPU and boards with memory and the SCSI controller and everything. So the first CPU was actually not very fast. It was 27 megahertz. 27.7, I think, and later they became closer to kind of metric numbers, 33 and 50, 75 and 100, and the second version was already made of two boards, and the third version they already made in silicon, so it was only one board for a CPU, and they actually made the system with the two CPUs, one board per CPU. So the architecture is more or less, from today's standpoint, is a normal RISC architecture. It's a pool of 32 registers and a very small, very simple instruction set operating only on the registers. And initially FPU was not included in the CPU, and sort of like on Sparks and the early PCs also, there were a number of companies producing different FPUs and different FPUs with different timings for different instructions. So people who used a lot of multiplications, they used sometimes the weighted CPUs because they did better multiply and division. And the standard FPU that HP had in the early days wasn't very well, but later they basically achieved 15 cycles per multiplication of single precision floats, which is much less than what, for example, Intel CPUs are doing today or Spark ever did. And these were quite huge machines back then, and the right after those, they made the desktop version when they actually produced the silicon. I have one of the similar machines here, if you want to check out them later. This is 720, actually. I have the 710, which is a slightly cost and CPU power reduced version of this one. And these ones already had the graphics, and the HP graphics, they started from the beginning with the a lot of functions embedded in the processor on the graphics card, such as primitives for two-dimensional graphics such as polygons and lines and all this simple stuff. And a good performance for graphics was also because the CPU, memory and graphics card were on the same bus. So for the graphics to access the data for drawing to memory was the same speed as for the CPU to produce the data. So the but basically on the 50 megahertz machine you get very reasonable X11 performance. On the workstation, of course, if you want to run modern Mozilla, it still doesn't work very well. But all the other peripherals were very much standard for the time. The same as Sparks at the later, a few years later. These machines came out in the late 80s and the 81.
When did the original TTL board come out?
TTL based, that was the 440 that came out in 86. After that, in 87, they made the smaller version, and in 88, the smaller version. And then the desktop versions, they came out in 91. And then they followed by a whole bunch of various desktop, more improved machines. And basically, the very first architecture was also not really complete. Lots of FPU instructions did only half work on the standard HP FPU, and the whole PRISC construction set, as they published later in the book, that was the version 1.1 PRISC architecture, that also wasn't completely implemented. But, well, again, since it was running the proprietary operating system, that wasn't a huge deal for the user. But for modern Unix, the PRISC 0.1 architecture wasn't very useful because they used the strange memory layout, not the flat address space, as kind of came from the VUX times, and wasn't very well documented, and different CPUs did it different ways, and so basically the whole thing settled around PRISC 1.1 architecture, and that's
was
what
that the influence from the Howard Parker 3000 machines with the segmented architecture that they had from there.
They didn't really have segmented architecture. Basically, there are two approaches to virtual memory organization. One approach, for example, how they implemented it on Intel, not the segmented one, but the paged, the paged architecture, and I think it came from VUX also. Basically, every time you switch in context, you have to switch the page tables set, which means you have to flush TLB more or less. So, what they usually do on, for example, on ARM, on PowerPC later also, and on MIPS, on the HPPA. They extend the address with what they call the space ID.
Okay.
So the initially they had 12-bit space ID, then they grew up to 16, 32, and I think modern ones have 48 or 64, well, the latest ones that they produced. But then basically the space ID is stored in the for the user space is stored in a register, which is only accessible by the kernel, by the zero level. So but they split the address space in four 1 gigabyte pieces, and for each gigabyte they created one register with space ID. And basically the idea was that if we have shared libraries, then the shared libraries, instead of being mapped and shared on the page level, they're mapped and shared between the processes on the address space level. So the first gigabyte was for the user stuff, the second gigabyte was for shared libraries, and the third was for user whatever. So basically if somebody runs a program and the libc gets mapped, it always gets mapped in the second megabyte, and then the second megabyte libc location in it is the same for all programs. So instead of duplicating the page mappings, they just reuse the space ID for everybody. But it sort of saves a lot of resources because the, all the page tables that have to back up the whole mapping takes memory also. But later they kind of went away from this system, and when I did the port for the OpenBSD, I just ignored the whole stuff. I used just one space register and everything else. Screw it. But basically they used two bits of the address to select the space register. But if you store the same value, then it's the same effect. Doesn't matter. And there are a few peculiar things that they implemented. For example, the system call. Traditionally, since it started from PGP 11 and VAX, the system calls were done with the TROP or user interrupt or whatever. And they, on HP, they figured out they can save some CPU cycles. So they made a two-instruction sequence to raise the protection level. So first of all, there has to be a page mapped. Of course, only kernel can do it because it has to be mapped with the zero protection level. And the only instruction it has is called a gateway instruction, which elevates the running protection level to the level of the page. So then one can jump to the page to this instruction and get elevated, and then the control continues. So basically, usually saves. So it looks like a function call, basically. Because, of course, on the RISC architectures, the CPU itself doesn't do context save restore. So from the user level, it looks like a function call, except it takes two instructions instead of one. And then, of course, kernel has to quickly reload. While it's staying on the zero page, it has to reload the space register so it can switch and start running the actual zero level code and stuff. So on one hand, it saves some cycles on the system call. But on the other hand, as we found out the hard way, it actually creates the race. If the interrupt or trap or whatever comes between the jump to the page and the gateway instruction, then basically it looks like you're running already in the kernel, but you're actually not. So when you're returning back from the kernel, you have to figure out, we're returning to user space, because you're not returning to the gateway page, you will be returning to actual user space. So this creates actually extra overhead, because every time you enter the kernel, you have to check, wait a minute, did we accidentally enter in between the two instructions? And the chance of hitting this race was approximately one in the one make build. It's, don't know how much people familiar with the BSD world, but basically BSD system contains all the programs and utilities that are needed for system function. So usually people who work with BSD, they measure everything in make builds. Make build rebuilds the whole system, regenerates all the user land libraries, everything that is being used basically. So having one hit in the make build means that somebody has to go and restart the make build, which is usually unfortunate, because usually you start the make build and you go drink beer, you come back and it's ready.
Sean said it's quite often, right?
Yeah, depends on how fast the machine. A little faster machine that I usually use at home, the make build is currently about 14 hours.
Okay.
Well, because of GCC. So you're using a... Well, I'm sorry, that's a fact. So using a faster compiler, like PCC, for example. PCC is not quite ready yet. I'm involved in the project also, but I haven't finished the port yet. There are a couple of strange bugs in there. But the fun part is that when the... HP was creating the HPX, they actually hired the university tutors, Mike Hibbler and a group of other people. Actually, they hired them five times to do almost the same job five times over. They ported one time, they ported two times, they ported 4.3 BSD, and that first time created HPX1. And the Second time they ported it again, and that was HPX something else later, and then the three times they did all sorts of esoteric microkernel something on top of something running. So one was BSD on top of Mach microkernel, second time there was Linux on top of same thing, and the third time there was some other microkernel and also Linux on top of it, but more or less the same people were doing it. And because of course they are all under NDA from HP, they cannot really help in efforts in the writing software for it. Other stuff also that for workstations, they also designed their own proprietary bus, what they call the General System Connect, which is basically a good old YAESA pimped up to 40 megahertz. And with removed all the PC dependencies. And later they added multiple transactions on the bus. So initially it was one, then it was one and a half. So it could be one outgoing and one incoming, and later it was two in any direction, anyhow you like. And basically all the fast devices, such as memory, CPU, and graphics, they were on one common bus, which is, I think they never called it anyhow, it's just this bus where they connect to each other. And then on later all the devices were on this General System Connect. Actually, the upper bus, sometimes they call it System Graphics Connect, just to confuse people, because it's SGC instead of GSC. And and sometimes, even if when you talk to HP engineers, you say like, yeah, we have this GC, blah, blah, they're like, no, that's SGC. It's like, how can it be? It's where the SCSI controller is, that has to be GSC. They're like, no, the docs says here is SGC. And generally, it seems like they had a lot of confusion inside the company. It was really hard to even make them find the documentation for anything. Once they find it, they might read it and answer questions. And later, they sponsored the Linux port for it, for 64-bit machines later, and the Linux people managed to squeeze the docs for the older stuff, but not for the newer stuff. But the newer stuff supposed to be a little bit better behaving than the old one, because the old one is full of magic everywhere. And as I mentioned, also where the MIPS cut the corners, both MIPS and the PA-RISC, similar to Spark and many other architectures, they implement delay slots and instruction nullification. So that's where the MIPS cut the corners, basically. The nullified instructions, or instructions in the delay slot, they couldn't use the registers that has been used, say, 4 or 5 cycles before the instruction. And there was actually a table for the first MIPS CPU where for every instruction, you have number of cycles when you cannot use any of the registers that this instruction used in the delay slot or nullified instruction. They fixed it later, of course, but in the beginning it was magic programming in MIPS. But HPPA didn't have this stuff, and there hasn't been any known issues like this, basically. And what they later did is they started basically integrating lots of stuff together in one piece, such as that they had the memory controller outside, it was a separate chip, and they all have funny names, and for some reason they are all some sort of snake or newt oriented. So the first series of the machines were actually called snakes, and I can look in the model list, and the machines were called similar. They were cobras, they were rattlesnakes, and all the internal machine name, the model, the names for each model of the motherboard, the machine, and CPU, they all had little snake names. Somebody told me that actually, initially they had a huge project with the India, and they made some kind of joke relation to Mowgli story. So they decided to like make everything snakes just because of that. But there is no documental proof of this, but it's still kind of fine. Later they changed it, and in 64-bit machines and the later CPUs, they became all kinds of animals. There are cheetahs and all kinds of fast animals, hawks, so some other ones. I would have to look in the list. And they also finding that, well, once they released the documentation, it's interesting to see how they evolved the products. Usually, their roadmap for one CPU is much longer than they ever use. For example, basically, internally, they have, for all the devices, CPU, FPU, memory controller, everything, they have ID numbers, kind of like on PCI bus. So you scan the devices, and by having the number, you can say what model it is. Of course, there is revision, minor revision, blah, blah, blah. But at least you have the major model number. So you know, okay, this is this type of CPU. It has these features. It does these things this way and that way. And for the whole motherboard, they also have a number. So you know what machine you're running on. Because even with the same CPU and same I/O devices, it still could be different motherboard. So for example, blinking lights could be connected differently. So you have to make sure you blink the right lights. They all have usually 4 to 8 blinking lights, which is, well, for debugging, I think it's indispensable. Because before you get to the frame buffer or to the serial port, you only have blinking lights, which is just bits in the register. It's much easier to signal where you are, at least. And if you look on the list of the motherboard models that they had, for example, they had the very small kind of size of the Spark Station 2 machine, the model 9712, which was meant to be a very simple kind of X-terminal machine. And they initially made only 40 megahertz, 60 megahertz, and 80 megahertz. But then if you look at the model list, they actually planned the 100, 120, 160. But they never made them because they made the new CPU before they actually reached the production of the faster, older CPUs. So they just started making completely new workstations with the new, faster CPU. But they seem like they have planning forward, and actually in HP nobody knows ever any machines been produced or why the numbers are there. But I think it's some sort of planning that they did, but never reached the points. So, so this is actually the small 712 machine I was talking about. The monitors they came with, that was about also 91, 92, I think. And the monitors they came with, I think they were sold all the way until 96, or 99 even. And the monitors, they were exactly the same as the ones that were sold with Sun workstations. Except the front plastic was different. And the back, the connector, they didn't use the 13W3. They used the either 3BNC or the normal VGA. But they had exactly the same Trinitron CRT. And
there's a Sony GDM series there.
Huh?
There's also a Sony GDM series.
Okay. And the exactly same sizes, same frequencies, same everything.
The silicon graphics had the same one also.
Yeah, they had also. I think everybody liked it. But these boxes were, first of all, it weighs almost nothing because it's plastic. It just has little stands in the middle so it doesn't flip. And has a power supply about here, so it's all the way through. And the power button is actually on the power supply. So the whole side of the workstation is a flat, small power supply. And then they have a floppy drive and then a hard drive here. And the motherboard is about this size. And they have everything on the motherboard. And basically, it's almost system on the chip because it basically had two chips. They had a CPU that had memory controller, cache controller on it. And then the other chip that had the bus adapter and the parts of the SCSI Ethernet and the serial ports and all this stuff. So basically, outside of it, there is only memory slots and a small, tiny logic here and there. And the, initially, they had the external SCSI, which is normal NCR SCSI controller that was also used on SANs and everywhere. Yeah. And later, they integrated everything in one chip also. So basically, later making workstations was just this tiny little boards that they had. And this was also kind of funny machine because it has no expansion possibilities. Usually they have either their own GSC slots for expansion or they have ESA or YEISA slots for additional devices. This one has nothing. It has two proprietary tiny slots for, there were I think total 6 or 8 different tiny cards like this created. There was one extra Ethernet, one secondary graphic, so you can have two monitors. It has audio on board also, but they had the codec, they had the split of the codec, so you can install another card and you can have a FOX modem with the voice on it. And so you can plug basically into the ports line and then you get and then you plug in, well, you need the software, of course, and then you plug in the garniture and the audio, and then you can receive faxes and you can talk on the phone and all with the same machine. So I think the idea was for like secretaries or whatever, people who deal with the phone a lot. And I think there was one card with serial port and one X25, dual X25, X21. Basically, it's a Motorola chip that they created. I actually don't know if it was ever widely used by anybody, but it was meant to be a protocol processor that Motorola made. So you can write a little piece of software that parses the protocol, and sort of like today they do TCP and IPsec offloading on the Ethernet cards. That was And the idea was that the whole X25 or necessary X25 protocols could be implemented on this board basically, and depending on the application you can upload the software. But also they didn't seem to be very popular. I think the most used ones, they were secondary graphic and the second Ethernet. The graphic is not super awesome here, it's only 8-bit. But this was the first machine that ever decoded MPEG, full resolution MPEG in real time. This was what they were also famous for. And even though the frame buffer is 8-bit, they invented this thing, what they call the color overloading. Basically, today we call it color maps. But what one can do is for a part, just a window, one can define its own colors on the board. So when this part of the frame buffer is displayed, it uses the other color map. So the difference is that if you use different color map in X, when you move your mouse, it changes the color map and flips. But in this case, it doesn't, because every window has its own private color map on the card. So when it renders the window, well, you define the rectangular area where the color map is active. So when you move the mouse, it doesn't flip, but when it renders, it just switches the color maps, basically. And that way they achieved basically 16-bit color resolution on the 8-bit graphic card. Okay. Because every window has its own 8-bit color map, but each color is basically 16 bits.
How much room does it support?
I forgot what was the space for the color map, but not that many, 4 or 8, something like this. Basically, it's limited by the memory. So the frame buffer, the standard frame buffer is 1 megabyte. You can buy additional piece of memory, then it's 2 megabytes. So that gives you basically 2,000 by 1,000 screen. So one possibility, you can standard resolution that they support is, I think the biggest they support on the screen is 1280 by, 1024. So then what usually things they did, they used it for scrolling or whatever. So you have like a little virtual desktop, or if you use color maps, you have to use the same memory. So then the right or the left part, whatever, of the frame buffer, you store your color maps. But because you also want to store fonts, for example, which you also can. And then the card itself can map the fonts also if you want to. That's how they sort of do not have a text mode yet, like you have on VGA. But you can flip the card in the mode where everything is, when you're writing in the frame buffer, everything is written with the same color. So you say, okay, background this, foreground that, and copy me. Then you store the fonts in the side of the frame buffer, and then you say, copy me this character from font there to here. So the card does it. You don't use the bus for that. And it substitutes the colors. So for you, frame buffer looks like 2 bits every time you copy the character, but every character could be different color. So it's not exactly pixel thingy, but it's much faster than drawing per pixel every time yourself. So the console driver is much faster than, for example, having a full screen extern where it does pixel everything. And of course, scrolling is the same. You don't do the scrolling yourself. The card does it for you. And what are the other basic functions? Yeah, filling up the stuff. The other stuff they never published, basically. The problem is that nobody knows why. Maybe they just don't have a very good documentation. They just write the driver and forget about it. And but basically, even this card is capable of doing basic 2D acceleration, drawing lines, rectangles, simple forms, filling with the fixed texture or whatever. But that stuff is not really documented, and some people actually tried disassembling the firmware, trying to figure out the entry points and how you do it, which is doesn't seem to be too complicated, except when you get the new version of the firmware, you have to do it again. Mouse pointer is the same, basically. It's like a piece of frame that you just overlapped with the screen. So mouse pointer is accelerated, and basically from the usage standpoint as a programmer, the only thing you care about is scrolling. If you accelerate scrolling, that's 90% of your everyday needs. The font, you can basically choose a simpler font or a smaller font and have it faster. But if the scrolling is too slow, it's hard to read the man pages. The good thing about graphics also, it's the same interface they kept all over the basic interface to do simple things. But to do more complicated ones, they kept private and they're changing it. And at some point they had awesome idea to store a driver for the X server for each card in the card. So when you starting up your X server, it can fetch the driver from the card and just link it dynamically into your X server, and then you have your super awesome acceleration. For some reason, they never implemented it. They implemented the interface, but the driver was never available. So maybe it's just another branch of the company. So these were the slightly different. It looks bigger, but actually it's not that much bigger. It's, well, you can scale by the CD-ROM size. It's a normal CD-ROM, basically. And this was the new kind of wave of workstations that they started. And they made a lot of different ones with the smaller CPUs, bigger CPUs. And then they came all the way to, that was when they started the Visualize series, basically. And also very inside, it's very awesome modular design. Like this block, this is one completely separate block. You unscrew this screw and you pull it out. And in the back there is a connector with power and SCSI bus. And here is one hard drive. In the bottom there is another one. And behind the CD-ROM there could be a third one. depending on the CD-ROM size. And you have your blinking lights, of course, the power buttons on the wall workstations are also software controlled, so it just gives you the interrupt, it doesn't turn off the machines. And the and inside also there is, about here, there is a stand-up with the extra cards, and it's all opening up like big paper folding bird, and they're very awesome to work with, and it's all like 2 millimeter steel. Once a wife of a friend of mine got really angry at him for playing with his toys, and she threw everything out of the window. The only machine survived was actually she didn't even turn them off, she just like went. It was only second floor in the house. She just went and threw it, everything running out the window. And this one, they had a crack somewhere on the front. But otherwise, the dude came back, turned it on, and it just worked. Everything else like had the cracked motherboards, all kinds of stuff. But this one, no problem. And for these ones, they started with before that small workstations that I showed before, they started kind of splitting CPU versions into expensive ones or server versions and the low cost for workstations and the small machines or low cost servers also. And for these workstations, they started with the more powerful ones, but then the numbers that they started, there was a PA7000, that was one of the first CPU, then it was 7100, then it was 7100 LC, low cost, that they used in that small workstation. And then next after that, they had the 7200 that they implemented actually a lot of new additional features in the CPU, such as in the 7100, they had only two instruction execution in parallel. And in 72, they added actually four. And on FPU, you can have their own four. And on FPU, they also made double instructions. For example, you have one instruction that adds two registers, stores, and operates on two pairs of completely independent registers. But because the FPU has separate units for addition and multiplication, and lots of, for example, data signal processing requires doing add, multiply. So they made an instruction. It's one instruction that adds two registers and stores in one, and then multiplies two other ones and stores in the other one. So you can keep the pipeline populated. Another thing with the FPU is also it's asynchronous to the main CPU, in the sense that while it's doing multiplication, it doesn't halt the pipeline on the main CPU. This, of course, creates additional funny effects, because the FPU exceptions are reported not when they happen, but when you actually touch the stuff that was produced. So if you have an FPU instruction here, and then you have a whole bunch of stuff not touching FPU, you don't know anything. Then you touch the FPU, you get an exception that, oh, there was overflow or something. But they give you the instruction, they don't give you the address. But because it's your program, you know where was your last FPU instruction, you're supposed to find it somehow. But they give you supposedly they have six registers, so you can have six simultaneously executing FPU instructions, failing and reporting your exceptions. And that's in documentation. But for some reason, one of them never worked. So they said, like, okay, make sure you don't execute five of them, more than five in parallel, because one register for some reason doesn't work. So, but that usually is not a problem, because, well, for average tasks, of course, if you do serious number crunching, that might be a problem. But for average tasks that we all do, I think FPU is not that super critical. And also, in the funny thing is that you cannot get away without FPU emulation completely. For example, on low cost CPUs, they figured out Well, things like converting between single and double precision, who needs that? You can implement that in software. So if you try to execute the actual instruction, you get a trap, and then you can emulate it and come back. So basically, your every kernel, even if you know, okay, I'm running on the machine that's supposed to have an FPU, you must have FPU emulation anyway. Because for some reason, there are some instructions also that for some corner cases, they trap as an unimplemented. They just like, it's too hard. You do it. And you don't know, it's not really documented. So for every revision, it's sort of like Vox microcode. When you know, you write a program, you sell it to a client, and you say, okay, you have to go buy this microcode from DEC or some other company that implements this awesome instruction that we are using, that like 100% of our software. And there's like, yeah, okay, but... And in the older PADs, well, in 32-bit PADs CPUs, you actually cannot, or at least it was never mentioned anywhere, you cannot modify the any kind of microcode. Well, the base CPU, of course, basically doesn't have microcode because addition, subtraction, and everything else is just simply done in hardware, and they all take fixed time.
Well, it's a risk.
But the floating point is basically some sort of thingy, and there are also funny instructions. Like, for example, they define the whole instruction set, and you can buy a book today, or you can even download it. PRISC 1.1, but then it has one magic instruction that's called diagnostic, which is 6-bit of opcode, and then the rest is whatever you want. And that instruction implements everything. There are instructions, diagnostic instructions, that allow you to lock entries in TLB, or allow you to read entries from TLB, or allows you to replace particular entries in TLB, or do whatever other stuff we don't know about. Well, some of it is, of course, questionable usage, but, for example, locking entries in TLB is... ...of the wire. Water. Probably not. Can we go? You have ducted it? Oh, that's possible. Just check.
It's
damn, it's better.
Fantastic. So you're just patching your hardware?
Everything's fixed. Yo. Mahlzeit.
I'm talking way too much today.
Coffee?
No, coffee.
Beer?
How long do
you need? I don't know. As long as you give me.
Well, that would be now. But beside that, what about 10 more minutes?
Okay.
First, Neil will be the next. And he needs for sure more than the rest of the day.
Sure. Okay.
But just enjoy.
Yep. Yeah, so things like locking entries in the TLB might be useful. But again, you don't know if the CPU supports it because there is no feature register. So you have to guess based on the CPU ID or revision number, blah, blah, blah. And then you might be wrong, and then it might not work as you expect, of course. So anyway, and these cases, I think, became so super popular that they kept them through lots of different CPUs, just replacing the motherboards. And eventually they came to the such contraption like taking an old motherboard and using a new 64-bit CPUs with the old motherboards, sort of. They just kind of modified the wiring, whatever. But the machine cannot run in 64-bit mode, but the CPU is faster, because the 32-bit CPUs, they stopped at 180 megahertz. That was basically the fastest one they sold. And the next fast one was the new 8000 model 64-bit CPU, which was 200 megahertz. So instead of continuing the 32-bit series, they just slapped in the old machine, and then they sold them for several years, up to, they were 200 to 20 to 40 megahertz, and then eventually they came to the 360, which is like insane performance, actually fast, more than twice faster than 180. But because, mostly I think because they actually replaced the, all the, their funky buses with normal PCI, they moved lots of devices to PCI, and the it was larger caches, about twice larger cache. And the, this is one of the also popular 8000, well, 64-bit machines with the 8000 class CPU. So this is basically, I think it's 7U in top, and the, most of it is just space for hard drives. In the back it has space for like 20 PCI cards. I actually don't know who needs 20 PCI cards. And of course redundant power supplies and everything. And the, I think it also had about four CPUs.
Yeah.
Up to four.
I think it's a server class.
Yeah, it's kind of small server class, yes. 19 inch rack mountable. And then I think I have a picture on the one of the really big ones. Yeah. What's this one? Ah, okay, this is basically the last ever produced workstation that they made. You sometimes can catch them on the eBay, about $500-$600. And the, it's super duper quiet. It has like these huge expensive propellers. And the front is full of hard drives and the back is full of hard drives. And inside I think there are like two or three cages for the PCI cards also. And there are models with two. Basically, they made those. I think it was first one was the 8500 CPU, and then the last one was the 89, if I'm not mistaken, which is a dual core 1.1 gigahertz, and you can have two of those in the machine. So you can have four cores at 1.1 gigahertz, and each CPU, which is two cores, has a 64 megabytes of shared level 2 cache. So basically you can just start it up, load the operating system and like remove the memory. Save power. And well, actually I got one of those and it's very awesome because it's completely quiet. It just starts up a little psh, but nobody ever wakes up from it. And the performance, well, also depending on the model, there could be different graphics card. It's actually front panel removed, there is no back. Anyway, sometimes they come with dual monitor, normal DVI connector monitors, and they, it's usually one of the latest FX5 or FX10 graphics card, which supposedly does full 3D. You like load the whole model of your airplane in there and just rotates it for you. Something like this.
They are from which year?
Well, the CPU, they officially stopped the whole project in 2010. So you probably should find, well, this one is just like the last ever produced because the PA-RISC is dead. In the 2005 or something, they sold completely designed the whole CPU design division to Intel, and they only continued the roadmap for 8700, 8900 CPUs, 8800, which they basically, they don't have anything super new in them. They're just faster, bigger caches, and well, dual core CPUs. And yeah, more memory, I think. They added a couple of bits for physical memory. So I think it's 46 bits they have for physical memory. So theoretically it's 64 terabytes, but I think in this box you can only get like 64 gigs or something. If you need to, I don't know why. have a huge memory disk and store your everything in there. Okay, so maybe there are some. Okay. As I said, I have two machines here. Then in the last row where the workstation stuff is, so I have one of the old ones and I have one funky laptop which is PRISC based also. It's also old, it's from 94 I think. So if anybody interested, you can touch it and check it out.